The next case this morning is Charlotte Martin against Shawano Gresham School District. Ms. Albrecht.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Timmy Jane Martin was a child, a 7th grade honor level 1 student. She was loved by her parents, the plaintiffs. She had many friends at school. She was active in school, in athletics and in choir, and had so much to live for like every other child. Tragically, 1 hour after being arbitrarily and summarily suspended from school, she committed suicide. She was all alone in her parents' home. She had been isolated from her parents from the moment that she was pulled out of class until her death. Her parents received no notice whatsoever of the imminency of her suspension, of the facts regarding the suspension, the duration of the suspension. Her parents, like her, had no opportunity to meaningfully participate in that decision and in that discipline. Yet at the very same time, in a case involving one of her classmates, Tabitha, the assistant principal called Tabitha's mom at work and waited and was present at school until Tabitha's mom came to school to pick up her suspended child.
Where is the foreseeability here?
The foreseeability, Your Honor, if it pertains to the risk of harm to her, comes from the evidence which was offered by several witnesses, only a few of whom were referenced by the district court. Particularly, Your Honor, the fact that Timmy Jane was crying from the moment that she had her locker confrontation with the assistant principal of Marinette. She was crying at the locker. She was crying when she went back to her classroom.
This is a very tragic case, as we all would agree, and that she is crying at the locker and all that, but I mean foreseeability that she's going to take her own life.
Judge Evans, that's not required. So long as the risk of injury exists, if there is a emotional distress situation of sufficient seriousness which was created or enhanced by the assistant principal, it is not a requirement of substantive due process that the exact injury be foreseen.
Well, what if she would have walked out of school and because she was sobbing, not being attentive, walked across the street and hit by a car? Would the school district be liable?
No, because there could be superseding events subsequent to the risk of harm being enhanced. But here we have a child who is in the physical custody of the school, essentially replacing the parents during the duration of the school day. She goes directly from her classroom and is placed on a bus to her home while the principal knows that she's going to an empty home and knows that she has been crying throughout this ordeal, and he also knows.
But how does that, even if he knows those things, how does he take the leap that he knows that something so serious is going to happen?
Well, Judge Evans, recall there were at least 4 prior suicides in this case, and he was aware of those suicides. One of those cases involved a child in similar circumstances who was suspended without parental notification. There is a problem with suicide in this school district. The suspension letters that are given to children, although they do not contain the panoply of due process rights that we believe are required, nevertheless, several copies go to the school guidance counselors and the social workers automatically for purposes of advising them that a child has been suspended and there may be attentive emotional problems.
Didn't the evidence that she actually inquired about getting her homework, or she was going to be gone for several days, and she was concerned about getting her work so she could work, and wouldn't, if that actually occurred, and I think it did, doesn't that just go contrary to somebody who's going to, a contrary signal that this person is going to go out and take their own life with them?
Well, Judge Evans, I think we would concede that that is one piece of circumstantial evidence that has to be viewed in the entirety of the circumstances that were known to Mr. Marinac at the time that the suspension took place and at the time that he put her on a bus to go home. That is one piece of evidence, but the more compelling evidence is the fact that we have a clearly distraught child who is described by several witnesses as crying very hard, kind of hyperventilating, having difficulty getting her breath, appearing beet red, appearing confused. We have a scene outside by the bus as she's going on the bus where other girls are gathered around her to comfort her. Meanwhile, the adult in charge is nowhere assuming responsibility for the circumstances that he has rendered her subject to.
Well, those circumstances, what if she would have hypothetically died of natural causes because of this hyperventilating situation? Would the school district be liable then?
Not inherently, but we believe there at least is the potential for a jury to consider, as a matter of causation, the extent and scope of injuries. What we are primarily concerned about at this juncture of the case is the fact that the district judge granted summary judgment and did not allow any for any opportunity for the plaintiffs to determine appropriately the scope of injuries that may have resulted and for which the school should have liability. Recall that in addition to the substantive due process claim, we are also asserting violations of procedural due process and equal protection. And we know from the Carey case, which arose out of the Seventh Circuit, that in Carey, emotional distress of whatever magnitude, is actionable and compensatory damages may be awarded for a violation of procedural due process. Because, as Justice Powell noted in Carey, we speak of procedural due process as an absolute right. The violation thereof, which gives rise inherently to nominal damages, but additionally to compensatory damages for emotional distress. And we have briefed those cases. So the first question is, if there is a violation, then we go to discuss the types of injuries under the various constitutional claims that may be compensable. But this court need not address and resolve those issues today, because that is appropriately for the instructions to the jury to decide upon the measure of damages.
So when you look at the process that was followed, obviously in hindsight there would have been some anticipation, I suppose, but given the situation that he encountered, the school day ended about the time the, whatever you want to call it, process ended with dealing with her. Now the question is, does she get on the bus or does he keep her there? It would be routine for her to get on the bus, wouldn't it, at the end of the school day?
With all due respect, Judge,
school just ended.
Right. Judge Mannion, with all due respect, the record demonstrates that Charla Martin had a routine of picking Timmy Jane up at school perhaps twice a week. And on this specific day, the routine was for her not to take the bus because there was baseball practice after school. Baseball practice was adjacent to the school, and she had made plans to go to baseball practice with her friends after school. So
did somebody know that besides she and her friend? Was the school on notice that this was the routine that the mother had put together?
Well, I can't answer that, Judge Manning, except to say that the school certainly would have a record of those days when she remains after school for such things as choir practice or other meetings.
Well, the record would be that she attended, I guess. Was this a school team?
No, this was the softball was a recreational league. It was not a school activity. Although she was but she was a member of the volleyball team, which of course would have practice. Recall also, Judge Mannion, that Charla Martin, when she arrived home, knowing nothing about what had occurred, did not find her daughter, got the telephone message. Mr. Marinac didn't even tell her, not only did he not tell her what had happened, did not tell her the nature of the suspension, did not tell her in this message of any hearing or due process rights, but she was left at a loss as to where her daughter was. She went first, not to the school, but to the softball practice field to look for her daughter, believing that that's where she would find her. It was only by happenstance that she then goes to the school and has a chance encounter with Mr. Marinac in the parking lot. She's in her car, and he's getting into his car to leave to go home. That was a chance encounter. She was expecting to find her daughter at baseball practice, and she was not there. Again, for purposes of summary judgment, I think it is important, and again, if I may return to Judge Evans' query, to simply highlight some of the evidence as to her emotional distress. Because recall, the standard under substantive due process is a standard that allows for inferences that if someone's condition is obviously in distress, whether or not the decision maker is actually aware of it is not determinative. Because in the Squadrito case and in the Kahn case, which followed the Supreme Court's decision in County of Sacramento versus Lewis, the principles of deliberate indifference were re-articulated in a way that allow for inferences to be drawn and culpability to be visited, even where an official may be, in the words of Judge Posner, obtusely unaware of the risk. Here we have a situation that's unfolding in the school between a classroom, a locker, back to the classroom, in his office, out in the hallway, out waiting for the bus. We have several reporters, neutral observers, who describe Timmy Jane in very dire straits, crying a lot, sobbing, having difficulty breathing, kind of hyperventilating. We also have the testimony of Brianna, a student who's observing them in the office, who testifies, quote, that he was pretty harsh with Timmy Jane. He was really yelling at her. His voice was raised. A reasonable inference could be drawn from that his own conduct exacerbated the situation significantly, and he should be charged with the duty of acknowledging responsibility for that, whether or not, while sitting there, he believed that she would commit suicide. That's not a question that has to be addressed today. The question is whether or not her and her parents' procedural due process rights were violated, and in the context of the process that did take place, also her equal protection rights were violated, and he exacerbated any pre-existing condition and caused her undue emotional distress, which he had a duty, even a common sense duty, to acknowledge and to ameliorate. And that he did not do.
Thank you, Mr. Albrecht. Mr. Heidenreich.
Thank you, Your Honor. There are multiple issues in this case, and already I'm thrown off the track of how I was going to argue in which order, but the court has spent a fair amount of time, as Mr. Albrecht has also, on the substantive due process. I would like to answer one question that the court posed to Mr. Albrecht, and that was whether or not Mr. Marinac knew how Tim and Jane was going to get home that evening. The record does establish that Mr. Marinac at, I believe it was 2:30, when the bell rang for the end of the school day, mentioned the buses are here, Tim and Jane, how are you getting home? How do you go home? And she responded, on the bus. True, the record does indicate that the parents would pick her up occasionally, but the fact is that Mr. Marinac did ask how she was going to get home that day, and Tim and Jane did say, I'm going to take the bus. I take the bus. In the substantive due process area, when we are judging the conduct of a teacher, an administrator, a police officer, I believe there must be some standard as to what, how he should perceive things and how he should respond. The briefs address the question whether or not a shocks of conscience standard should be used, whether or not a deliberate indifference standard should be used. Regardless of which standard is used, even the lowest standard, the deliberate indifference standard, does imply some awareness that there is a potential for some harm. In order to impose liability on the part of Mr. Marinick here, would be paramount, in my belief, to impose liability on the part of a school for every time that a student is in that class, in the school, and is crying, regardless of whether the crying is because the student gets a grade lower than her expectations, regardless of whether that child does not make a particular forensic team or is cut from a basketball team.
What about here? It seems to me that this fellow was a little harsh. But, I mean, that may not be all that important here, but this was a pretty severe punishment for having a cigarette in her locker. But there was a book in that locker about suicide, apparently.
Yes, there was a book. I believe it was called After Suicide.
Does that cause some bell to go off, or should it, for a administrator who is not being indifferent to the needs of these young kids to a distraught young girl at this locker? She's going to be suspended. She has a suicide book in the locker. What's the reaction that should be expected as an administrator in that situation?
Two aspects. First of all, I believe the court may be assuming that Mr. Marinick knew that that particular book was in the locker.
Well, that might be a jury question.
That potentially would be. I would agree. He went to the locker.
The book clearly was there.
The book was there. It was also should point out that it was also a library book. It's not a book that she brought from some other source. It was part of the library.
Well, what difference does that make?
Well, in theory, one could, Mr. Marinick, if he did see that book, if he did recognize it as a library book, could assume that it was part of her academic endeavors. But putting that aside, and those are, I would agree, that those perhaps are questions for the jury.
I mean, as a parent, I guess if my kid in seventh grade was reading a book about suicide, I want to know why they're doing that.
I would. If I had my child, I have young children, I would ask them why they're reading that book. I agree. But to answer the court's question as to what this should do as far as drawing some awareness on the part of the administrator, I think that's only part of the formula. Yes, it should be incorporated into his thought process. I would concede that. But, again, a child crying in school because she was suspended, and the suspension, and I don't believe the appellants are even arguing that the suspension was not proper, that it was in violation of the school rules. One could argue whether or not it was too harsh, but it was the school rule, and the schools clearly have the authority to make rules that they feel are appropriate. And they did, in fact, enforce this rule uniformly. I don't see anything unusual about a middle school student crying in school. They cry all the time. That's just a historical fact. It can cry for any reason. To impose liability on the part of the school for every time someone's crying, if they don't start thinking, oh, this girl might be a threat to harm herself, I think borders is a non-ending process. What about a police officer who stops a motorist for a simple traffic ticket? No confrontation with the police officer. There's no issues of constitutional violations as far as the stop. But that motorist, whether that be a 16-year-old or an 80-year-old, becomes upset and starts crying.
Well, there's a special relationship, though, between a student and a teacher or administrator. It's more of a parental a situation, isn't it?
I believe
it's not giving a ticket to somebody.
I believe the case law very clearly does indicate that there is no special relationship between a student and a school from the fact that she is a student in the school. I mean, under the constitutional definition of special relationship, I don't believe.
Maybe under the constitutional definition under
if the court
asks, or cases like that, there may be no special relationship here. But it is a different relationship that a teacher has to a student, or administrator to a student, and a police officer to some complete stranger that's stopping for a traffic violation.
In that sense, the court is correct, as long as I'm not conceding that there's a special relationship between Mr. Marinick and Tim and Jane Martin. But I fail to see how that makes a difference. Because whether or not the teacher is more familiar with Tim and Jane than a police officer who would stop her for smoking on the street, which is in violation of the city ordinance, the fact remains their conduct is going to be held to the same standard. That standard being whether or not they increased the danger or created a danger. Certainly the danger here exists, of suicide existed prior to Mr. Marinick ever seeing Tim and Jane. The record is clear that Tim and Jane, unfortunately, was talking about suicide that very afternoon during the noon recess. She clearly told a friend that she was going to commit a suicide, totally unrelated to school activities. It was a boyfriend-girlfriend situation and her perception of her looks. And she had told this girlfriend that she was going to commit suicide, I believe, by hanging. One of the tragedies in this case is that that young girl who received this information did not convey that information onto anyone at the school. Now, clearly, if that information was known to the school, if the school was aware that here was a girl who is now crying, who had been talking about suicide, I think then we are getting closer to the responsibility that the school should do something. But absent this knowledge, absent this awareness being conveyed onto the school, they had no such information. Unless the court has other questions on the procedural due process, I'd like to touch upon some of the other multiple issues that this case raises.
Are you talking about the procedural due process or the substantive due process, or are you blending those together?
No, they're very clearly distinct.
When you were talking about deliberate indifference and that sort of thing, you're dealing with substantive due process, I suppose.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Yeah. So then when you're talking about what they're supposed to do along the way, one thing I would wonder if when this girl checked the book out of the library, is that an alert that they should have reacted to?
I can't envision how it would be. It's a library book. We don't know. There's no record as to when she checked that book out. I don't know if it was that day or a month earlier.
I'm just looking at the distinction between, I know he said he didn't see the book, but if he had seen it, at what point, I guess, is someone supposed to go to a higher level of alert? What is the school expected? That's what I'm just forgetting to that discussion about the suicide book. I just wonder to what extent someone having a book, the school has it there, obviously, for some reason. So, anyway, that's fine. Go ahead.
I would like to turn just for a few moments to the issue of procedural due process. Appellants argue that the school district, by both Mr. Marinick's conduct as well as by board policy, violated the procedural due process. What appellants are arguing is that there is a duty, or it's not a duty, that under the procedural due process, part of that obligation is to inform a parent of a child who's being suspended prior to the suspension and giving the parents the right to attend a formal hearing. That, I do not believe, is at all the law. Groves and the cases in the Seventh Circuit clearly indicate procedural due process simply requires minimal due process, that being the being informed of the charges and being given an opportunity to be heard. The record is clear that did in fact occur. They argue, appellants argue that Wisconsin Statute 120.13 sets forth a standard that requires notification to the parents of the suspension prior to the suspension. I have taken a look at that statute. I have read that statute many times. It does not state that. What that statute says is what the Supreme Court has said and what the Seventh Circuit says is that there is minimal due process being noticed, an opportunity to be heard. Then the statute goes on to say that the parents shall be given prompt notice of the suspension. Parents were given prompt notice of the suspension. Phone call was played that day. A letter, as the record would reflect, would have gone out absent the tragedy that occurred that would have formally informed them by written documentation that a suspension had occurred for what violation and for the period of time. There is no requirement under the procedural due process for the school district to do more than what they did. And I believe the appellants are in error in arguing that procedural due process requires more than what the school district did in fact do and what they did in fact extend to Tim and Jane and her parents. Another area that is was raised by the appellants in their brief and as well as in this argument is a argument under the equal protection. They allege that the plaintiff, that the school district violated the Tim and Jane Martin's equal protection rights. What the appellants fail to do, though, is to set forth the case law as to what an equal protection violation is, what the standards are. What they want to argue is that Tim and Jane Martin's parents were not called before the end of the school day, but Tabitha's parents were. The record reflects that Mr. Marinick didn't have the time. The school day ended, he called the parents. They were treated equally. Appellants have failed to point out to the court, and I'm in error, but I am not aware of any case law that says two people have to be treated identically and completely similar.
Yes, they weren't brought in at the same time, obviously. As I recall, Tabitha, she, in effect, told on Timmy Jane.
They were not caught in at the same time. The facts are that Tabitha, and I frankly don't know how Mr. Merrick became aware that Tabitha had a pack of cigarettes, but he became aware of that information, pulled Tabitha into his office. Tabitha at that time then indicated that while I gave some cigarettes to Tim and Jane, Mr. Marinick said, stay here, stay in the office, went down, had the conversation with Tim and Jane, brought Tim and Jane back to his office, so now they're there together. As to whether they were pulled in together, no. Were they, at the end of the discussion, were they informed of the penalties? They were together at that time. Perhaps there was some overlapping.
But who called? But one, he was able to get a hold of one parent and not the other. Is that?
Well, what occurred was that Mr. Marinick, in a prior conversation with Tabitha before Tim and Jane was there, called Tabitha's mother.
Well, before Tim and Jane.
Before Tim and Jane was there. This was during the school day. Tabitha's mother was at work, left the same type of phone message. It's interesting. It left a message at her place of work saying, call me, your child's been suspended. Didn't reach her at that time. Then, when he had now Tim and Jane in the office, that was when when Tabitha's mother called back. So they were treated the same. Phone calls were made different places. Phone calls to Tim and Jane's parents at home, Tabitha's at work, but phone calls were made, same result, initially no response, left a voice message. I suspended your child for possession, cigarette, give me a call when you have the chance.
Thank you.
I see my time's over.
Thank you, Coach.
And that only covered about a third of the half the issues here. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Albrecht, you have a minute, 40 seconds.
Tabitha and Timmy Jane were not treated equally for purposes of the Equal Protection Clause because each had procedural due process rights. They were in the office together. Marinick actually reached and gave notice to Tabitha's mother. He did not call Timmy Jane's mother at work, although he knew that she was at work. He made no effort to call her at work. He made no effort to call her father. He made no effort to contact the emergency contact card. There was no note. He left the most convenient message of all on an answering machine at the parents' home, knowing they were not there. That is not equality of treatment when constitutional rights are at stake.
Did you leave that before or after she left?
They were together. Tabitha.
No, before or after Timmy Jane left for the bus, you know?
After. Timmy Jane had already departed on the bus when the message was left. The record indicates that the phone call was made perhaps between 2:45 and 3:15 p.m.
That was my question. I know you want to finish up.
Yes. With respect to the bus, the testimony is from Mr. Marinac directly, quote, "I put her on the bus." A second quote from Mr. Marinac, "I sent her home on the bus." Tabitha was asked, "But he told her to get on the bus?" Tabitha's answer, "Yeah." Also, Charla Martin testified in her affidavit that in her conversation with Mr. Marinac in the parking lot, that he told her that he sent Timmy Jane home on the bus. That conflicts with the version of the testimony that Mr. Heidenreich presented. And that is why summary judgment, among many other reasons, is inappropriate. Thank you, my time.
Our thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.